Are you looking to sell your property without all the usual headaches associated with traditional property sales? Maybe you're looking for a straightforward, hassle-free, quick sale. We've got you covered at G67 Home Buyers. Ditch the stress of endless viewings, the waiting game with property chains, and the buyers missing deadlines. No matter the condition or location of your property, we're ready to buy. And guess what? We'll give you an instant cash offer, no traditional hoops to jump through.
We get it. Sometimes you just need to sell fast, and we're here to make that happen. We'll often be able to buy in just a few days. You no longer need to worry about the sale falling through after weeks or months. We have buyers ready now.
We handle everything for you, even paying your legal fees, and there is no hidden fees or estate agent commissions to pay. Just a smooth, easy sale with us by your side, helping you every step of the way. I am David Smith, and I will personally help you find a hassle-free solution to selling your property fast, beginning with a free, no-obligation cash offer for your property. Remember, I am here to help, so get in touch in the link below and let's chat.
Welcome to Social Sessions. I'm thrilled to be joined by a remarkable guest, a powerhouse in the world of law within the UK, a fervent advocate of the law. Chris possesses an extraordinary blend of empathy and compassion when it comes to his outlook on both legal issues and social issues. An advocate for reform within the judicial system, his remarkable courage within the courtroom is unparalleled. With a resounding and imperative message, it is my absolute pleasure to present to you to the remarkable Chris Daw KC. So, hi and welcome to Social Sessions, esteemed KC, Chris Daw. So what I'm going to do, Chris, is just kind of take you back to your own kind of childhood and stuff. So where was it you were kind of born yourself?
I was born in Milton Keynes, a glorious city of roundabouts and not much else. And I grew up in the 70s there. It was a bit of an odd place, really. I guess it's the very middle of Middle England. I mean, it's about as in the middle of the country as you can get. And very sort of ordinary place, very ordinary schools there. No sort of mystical, magical, wealthy benefactors or relatives in my background.
So what kind of drew you into the kind of legal system? What kind of drew you into that kind of that career, Chris?
Well, that's a good question. It was actually a computer because when I went to sixth form, having kind of left home for a couple of months to try to make my fortune selling donuts and cans of Coke on beaches in the south of France, realizing that wasn't going to work out in the long run, I came back to find that my mum and dad had actually moved up to Merseyside, a place called Southport. And I managed to just about scrape into the local sixth form college. And when I was coming up to sort of university applications, I went to the Career Centre and they had like a computer where you could put in what you liked and answer questions and so forth. And it gave you a printout of actual paper at the end. And it comes out and it says, there's only two jobs for me. One is barrister and one is actor. So they were the only things apparently that the computer thought I was capable of doing. And even the computer wasn't entirely confident on either score. But basically, I went to the local Crown Court up in Liverpool over the summer holidays, watched two or three trials, including some really funny ones where like the defences were a little bit improbable, let's put it that way, but still succeeded up in Liverpool. As I think he's got a reputation for being a sort of defendant's paradise up there. So I watched these trials for 2-3 weeks and over the summer holidays and came back to college and said, I know what I want to do. I'm going to be a criminal barrister. That's the thing for me. So it was all down to a computer. Otherwise, who knows? Gas board could have been anything.
So I'm just going to take you to the kind of what it was like when you first kind of became a lawyer and stuff. What was the legal landscape like at that time, Chris?
Well, it was different and the same, which I know is a contradiction, but it was different in the sense that we sent a lot fewer people to prison. So our prison population back in the early mid-90s when I started out was about half what it is now. And sentences were much lower, particularly for drugs and murder cases and other kinds of crime. You know, the sentences were sort of half the length of what they are now. So it was a kind of different landscape in terms of risk. I think that there was a lot more resource in the system. So I think generally speaking, defendants in England, at least where I was practicing, got a sort of fairer trial and a better defence than they get now, because the cuts have been so bad that, you know, many people on legal aid, you know, if they're lucky enough to qualify at all, which many people don't, but if they do qualify for legal aid, sadly, it doesn't cover very much. So you know, I think we're in a situation where things have worsened a lot from the point of view of justice. And from the point of view of looking at, you know, trying to find ways to avoid getting people into the criminal justice system or divert them away from it, particularly in their young lives and teenage lives and childhood, if anything, I think things have got worse and we've become more and more addicted to prison as the political solution for everything. I'm not saying that wasn't the case to a degree back then, but I think there's a lot more emphasis on sort of rehabilitation and diversion than there is now. Even though we talk the talk about it, really, we don't walk the walk.
No, I totally agree. And I think it's kind of similar up in Scotland as well, Chris, in the way that the prison systems are really broken at the moment. And I speak quite a lot about it. I've had quite a lot of people on talking about it and stuff. And it seems to be a place where, I don't know how you feel about this, but when you send somebody to prison, it seems to open a doorway for them into a kind of criminal. That's it. As soon as you go to jail, it starts that kind of revolving door. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't know how that is. Is that the same in England?
It's exactly the same in England. I'm not sure how statistically whether there's a huge difference, but I doubt it. But I think the main problem is that you're rightly pointing out it's not so much. It's not when sort of 30 or 40-year-olds go to prison for the first time, because that's quite rare, actually. It's generally when young people, particularly teenagers going into young offenders institutions, when they go in at 15 or 16 or 17, or even like late teens, early 20s, the problem is that from that point onwards, it's almost impossible in our society to just put it behind you and move on and kind of live a law-abiding life and get away from sort of crime and criminal associates from sort of early in your life. And so you're absolutely right. The whole system, in effect, I mean, if you just think about it, and I wrote about this in my book, but someone coming out of prison at the age of 20, 21, whatever, and they've been in for a year or two or however long it is, basically they usually have got nothing left. I mean, that, you know, their families are, you know, probably not so keen on supporting them. And if they're lucky, that, you know, they might have somewhere to live, but often they don't. And so, and if they had a sort of an addiction or a habit before they went in, then they've probably still got it, if not a different or worse one from being in prison. And so they're coming out with basically no chance. And if someone's got no chance, the only kind of family they've really got is the family they met inside or the people they knew before. And, you know, unfortunately, that just, as you say, it just leads back to that inevitable revolving door. And you know, I've spoken again in the past about clients of mine who were in their 50s who'd only been out for about 3 years since they were 18. And that's not because they killed anyone. It's just because they kept going in and in for like a year and two and three and eventually five and seven. All for stuff that's often like not sort of actually harming anyone. You're talking about stupid stuff involving drugs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you know, to me, it's just a form of madness that we're addicted to, and we can't get past because, unfortunately, the public, when they go to vote at election time, either don't care about criminal justice at all, it's not an issue for them, or they're attracted by these arguments that let's lock people up for longer because that's got to be a good thing. Well, unfortunately, we've done that. You know, as I say, we've doubled sentences, we've doubled our prison population. And is it, you know, nobody's ever happy. The more you lock people up, people just want more of it. It is almost like an addiction in and of itself as a society that we have to locking people up, even though it's staring you in the face. It doesn't work. It makes things worse. So it's utter insanity. And you're right to say that it's particularly prevalent in the UK as opposed to many other countries in Europe where they have a very different approach and achieve much better results.
So, see, like we are talking about, obviously, I read a thing no long ago, Chris, and it was saying Netherlands had kind of closed down quite a lot of their prisons. It was actually it was quite surprising, the actual amount they'd closed down. And obviously, look at the kind of Scandinavian model. What kind of things would you bring into the kind of UK that you would see, obviously, rehabilitation and stuff when we talk, but what kind of stuff would you try and do?
Yeah, well, I would start with a blank piece of paper because, you know, I think we've got the whole thing wrong. I mean, from top to bottom, from policing to the policing in particular of young children and the way that they engage with criminal justice, right through to, as I say, that revolving door of criminality and prison sentences. So what I would do is just rip it all up and say, look, nothing we're doing now really works. So what can we do that's completely different but might work? And one of the things that I'm really passionate about is that we should stop criminalizing children. Completely, no matter what they've done, no one at the age of 18 should start their adult life with a criminal record. And that means that, yes, if young people do things which are violent or dangerous, you're going to have to address that behavior. But we need to address that behavior in a non-criminal justice way. So, you know, in the worst case example, and there are very, very few actually young people who kill or commit the most serious acts of violence, by which I mean under 18. That's very rare, actually, even though the headlines tell you something different. But with that group of, you know, violent or potentially dangerous individuals, you would need a secure institution. But I would go for a secure school, which was genuinely aimed at welfare and education and life lessons and life skills, rather than, as you have up in Scotland with Polman and other places, you know, with the best will in the world, places like that are just prisons for kids. And prisons for kids produce prisoners who then go into prisons for adults. If we scrap the whole idea of criminalizing children, then, you know, the most kids who get into trouble with the police, if they had a clean slate at 18 and they'd had education right the way through and hadn't been sent to a sort of prison-like environment, most of them would grow out of it, either 18 or 20 or early 20s. They'd grow out of whatever it was. And if they're given support in their lives for addictions and the abuse that many have suffered who are in the criminal justice system, we would find that instead of having 50, 60 year periods of incarceration for these kids, we'd actually find them, you know, in their mid 20s, they'd actually have grown out of it with that support, and they'd be doing, you know, education, careers, etc., like everybody else. So I think that's a really, really important thing, is just to change the whole mindset. Let's not criminalize things just because it sounds like we should. You know, we've had a big thing on knife crime in England. You know, let's lock up 15 and 16 year olds for a first time of carrying a knife. If you do that, you're going to make them criminals forever, almost certainly for decades anyway. Whereas if you said, okay, why are they carrying a knife? What's the background? What's going on in their life that they're in this situation? And that look to address all of those kind of lifestyle, you know, trauma in the home, trauma outside the home, everything else that goes with that kind of background. Look to try and resolve or deal with those issues. You'll find that, you know, just like anyone who's given a chance as a child because they made a mistake, you know, they'll grow out stuff and they'll become productive. So I think you have to start really radical differences in the way that we teach young people. And then all the way through the rest of the system, you know, there's the madness of the prohibition of drugs, which I just find so utterly insane that we essentially create and incentivize this huge worldwide drug cartel, drug supply network with all of the violence, everything that goes with it. We've created that as societies by prohibition, not, you know, drug dealers fill the, you know, the space that we make for them, and we've made that space for them, and they understandably fill it. So that's another form of insanity I think needs to end. I, you know, equally importantly, you know, along this sort of journey, we just need to say to ourselves, in every single case, very, very few people who go to prison actually should be there. You know, it's maybe 10-20% of the prison population who need, you know, they need to be in custody to protect everybody else from their violent behavior. And even then, much of that may be able to be addressed in different ways. But most of them are just damaged people, you know, addicts, people with serious mental health problems, people with a background of extreme trauma, which most of us can't imagine. And you just have to accept that putting such people in prison doubles down on whatever's happened to them and makes things worse. So a complete radical reset, I would say, from top to bottom of the system.
No, I agree with you. I spent a long time in prison. I was in prison for like 15 years. And I was obviously, people say to me, Sean, how did you turn your life around? How did you do it? And I say, look, I'm still damaged. I still have that stuff in my life that I need to deal with. But what I'd done was I had to accept that the reality was that I've got two different kind of paths here I can take. I can go down this road of addiction, insanity, all this kind of stuff, or I can address it. And it is taking a wee bit of responsibility. But the difference, Chris, and I'll always say it, is I had a massive support network. And it was, that was what my mum, my family, I had a great partner, I had loads of good friends, I had actually really good social workers at the time. So I was very, very lucky. Do you know what I mean? And that's the only reason.
Do you know what? You're right to use the word lucky, because you would know better than me. But out of all the people you spent time with behind the door over those years, how many did have all of that support? I mean,
honestly, a handful, Chris.
So, you know, that's the thing. You had the benefit of something which the rest of us perhaps take for granted. You know, who don't get caught up in criminal justice. You know, let's say family network, support networks, etc. Most people in prison, one of the many reasons or main reasons they're there is because they never had any of that. And because they got drawn into addiction and crime at a very young age, often, you know, as young as 8, 9, 10 sometimes, you know, in terms of drug gangs, you know, and so you were very, very lucky. And as a society, we kind of have to realize that most people in prison are not that lucky. Yeah. So we can take a choice. We can either just abandon them to become perpetual residents of one prison or another, or we can actually try and provide some of that structure via other routes and other services, and in particular by making sure that we think about, you know, often when people are sentenced, and I've had this over the years, you know, we've got letters, you know, where people are lucky enough to have family, mothers and or partners or whoever supported them, and the judge can just say, well, they should have thought about that before they committed the crime, and it's tough shit, basically.
I know.
But hold on a minute. What we're saying to you is they've got a support network. If you don't send them to prison and you put in place, you know, addiction, therapy, whatever it might be, all of the other kind of protective factors that people need, like a home that, you know, is secure and they're not going to get thrown out of and everything else, then they're going to actually just resolve their issues and probably in most cases move on with their lives successfully. But if we don't, we're just mad, as I say, we're just doubling down, we're making it worse. But you're very, very lucky, Vaughan, and it's interesting that you kind of recognise that. I mean, I've had clients, you know, in my past, who have been able to escape from that sort of revolving door of serious crime, you know, drugs, guns, mm-hmm. whatever it might be. But only those ones who have got someone on the outside, usually their mum, but someone on the outside who sticks by them, no matter what happens, no matter what sentences they get. But we all know the phenomenon of people who just don't get visitors because nobody, you know, everyone's just sort of given up on them, you know, after a year or two or three. It's quite common for people to have almost no visitors after 3 years of a long sentence. And, you know, when you can just imagine what that's like coming out when you know yourself because you'll have seen so many in that situation.
No, you're so right, Chris. And what I try and say is when you go into prison, I wrote a book about it, obviously, about my book, about how you really need to disconnect for yourself when you go into prison. The environment's so toxic. So when you go into prison, that disconnect takes time and you learn a set of kind of rules and the rules are flipped. So everything that we can see in society, like violence is celebrated, drug taking is celebrated, antisocial behaviour. So when you're putting somebody in that for like years upon years, what is it you're expecting them to turn out like when they come out? And then how can you demonize that person? And understand that people need to take responsibility. But when you're asking, when you take somebody's, because going into prison, you're essentially taking their full responsibility off them. So you're teaching them how to live with responsibility. And then when you send them out, you're saying, right, now be responsible for yourself. And you're like, how can you expect this guy?
Hence, you have the system in Norway, which is very successful, where the prisons don't look like prisons. And the idea of a prison is, firstly, you only put people in prison who are a danger to the public. You don't punish people for its own sake, because we all know where that ends up. And unfortunately, that's a big part of our system. But yes, there are some very violent and dangerous people that need a period of time where they are in secure conditions. But I don't need to be in a prison that has that clanging gate and, you know, all the stuff that goes with our kind of Victorian jails, which still, you know, often exist up and down the country. And they're allowed to have normal living conditions. They live in sort of shared apartments with other inmates. They can cook their own food. So they can maintain the life skills that, you know, you're going to need on the outside and a degree of responsibility and independence. And in the end, actually, if they get through a period of time, they can have their family, their cottages in the grounds. They can have their family for weekends and stuff and get just gradually ease back into a sort of normal life. We just let people like go, as you say, in that sort of complete subculture of prison for however long they're in there until the day they come out from this fucking great massive brick wall through the thing. And then what's next? And the answer is often, particularly for people who've been in like yourself for a very long time, the answer is no idea what's next. I don't even know what the world looks like anymore, let alone how I'm supposed to kind of cope with it, how I'm supposed to get a job with a significant criminal record and all the other stuff. What are you going to do? You just call whoever you've either met on the inside or whoever you knew. Mm-hmm. You only get back with whoever it is because that's the only kind of structure you've ever had. And it's a toxic structure, just like prison. So we need to learn lessons of what actually works. And you know, these other systems around Europe in particular and other places, they do work. They produce people who, on the whole, don't reoffend after they're released. 20% recidivism rate in Norway. In our system, it's 80% within 2 years of young offenders institutions. And, you know, any other system that had such a crap outcome, you'd just scrap it. It wouldn't survive.
Well, absolutely.
But we're addicted. Good.
No, you're so right. It's see, when I was obviously 19 when I went into prison, and I came for a quite, I mean, I wasn't I came for quite a good background just outside Glasgow. It wasn't really, I wasn't involved in that kind of gang culture like the way it was in Glasgow. But you think you are when you're kind of hanging about the streets and you're in your wee kind of town. But as soon as you hit Pullman, you just realise straight away, oh my God, like I'm so out my depth here. And it was a big realisation for me. But what you do learn is very quickly you learn survival. You learn to survive in a place, and if you don't, you become a victim. So yeah. it's very hard, Chris, to kind of explain to somebody. I always say, like, the justice minister or whoever should be going and spend a month in the prison just to actually see what it's like and say, oh my God, is this what's happening here? Do you know what I mean? You've got guys here like Spice and the new Atizalam stuff that's going to prison. And people know it's killing them, but that escapism for that couple of hours that they're getting is enough to kind of that, and that just shows you how much people are trying to connect with something. The kind of lack of connection is huge. But I kind of touch on, I noticed you on Twitter, Chris, and it was because of your tweets, and I could see that you were very, very passionate about reform and stuff. And I was really taken by a KC that had that kind of outlook. How does that go when you're in amongst maybe other KCs and stuff that don't have that outlook? How does that come across?
Well, it's interesting because I actually think the great majority of people who work in the system, obviously the people who are kind of behind the door have got a very, you know, unique perspective. But those of us who work on the, you know, in courtrooms or in probation or policing, etc., I think most of us actually have a broadly similar view that the system's completely dysfunctional. And that broadly the reasons are exactly as I've suggested in terms of, you know, this sort of perpetual use of criminalisation, prohibition of drugs, etc. So I think everyone kind of broadly shares those views, and many, many judges certainly do. But the difficulty is that the laws are made by Parliament, and Parliament is full of politicians, and politicians, as you rightly point out, don't really have any experience of what prison is really about and what it's really like. So they're not speaking from any form of informed position. They don't really care about the evidence about what works and what doesn't work and what makes crime worse or better. All they care about is sound bites. And the soundbite is, we are going to, I mean, Boris Johnson did this in 2019. We'll lock more people up. They're getting out too early. They're not doing enough time in prison. We're going to increase the amount of time people spend in prison. And the public go, yeah, great, I love that. Yeah, we love it. Yeah. But that's the problem. So you've got a disconnect between the people who know exactly what we need to do to make things better. And by better, I don't mean better just for people in custody, but that is an important part of it. But I mean better for society. And the most important thing of all, surely, from any criminal justice system, is that it is in some way effective in reducing the amount of crime and reducing the number of victims in society. That, for me, that will be the number one. They will be the two most important things. And you don't achieve either of those things by using prison in the way that we do and by having this punishment mentality. You achieve those things by focusing from the minute someone has any interaction with the criminal justice system, and usually that's as a young person arrested for the first time or caught up, for example, in Scotland. There's many young people who come to the, you know, the police become involved in their lives because a parent has committed suicide or overdosed or some, you know, horrific thing has happened, and they get interaction with the police in those circumstances or of course being arrested, as I say. But if we just focused on how do we make sure that this is the last time they have an interaction with the criminal justice system, from the first second that we deal with a young person in that situation or a person of any age, rather than what have they done, what's the appropriate punishment? Because by approaching it from that end of the telescope, we're just perpetrating and repeating this cycle of violence and cycle of drugs and cycle of imprisonment, which ultimately, in the end, the biggest price payers are both those who end up in prison repeatedly, but also all of the victims. You know, all of those people whose homes get burgled because someone's has to buy heroin at huge prices from the dealer or whatever it might be. All of that stuff, we're just making our entire criminal justice system actually achieve the opposite of what I've suggested it should be about. Reducing crime, reducing harm. It does neither of those things at the moment. It actually doubles down on both. And I think a massive reset, political reset, would be the way forward. But you and I both know, you know, you follow you know, the politics of this and the policies and the way that census policy is being developed. I've not seen any sign of the direction of travel going in the right direction. All of it, it seems, politically, certainly south of the border, all of it's going the wrong way.
No, I think when you've got a justice minister who is maybe talking about what we are talking about, it's definitely not a seller, because what happens is the tabloid newspapers jump on it, and I mean the tabloids, I mean the kind of red tops will jump on it, and they kind of jump on maybe somebody saying something like just what you're saying, Chris, or maybe like Dr. Nutt, when Dr. Nutt came out and said, look, alcohol's worse than half the drugs that are on the street. These are the things that people then ridicule and try and, oh, and it's not a seller. It's in politics, it isn't sales, you know what I mean? But how would you kind of change that in the way that you would maybe give them a bit more awareness, Chris? How could you give the politicians a bit more awareness?
Do you know what? I suspect there's two kinds of politician. There's the kind of politician that already knows all of this, and who doesn't care because politically it doesn't fly. So you can't get ahead in the Conservative Party, for example, by arguing for reduced sentences and not criminalising children, because immediately the pushback will come. What about Jamie Baldwin? What about this? What about that? All of these arguments. Yeah, you've got, you know, these are terrible, evil individuals. What are you talking about? So there's those who know the truth and know reality, but kind of politically it doesn't suit them. And then there's another group who doesn't know because they're ignorant and they're not interested and they don't care and they're just interested in the politics. And actually, in fairness, there's probably a third group. It's a tiny, tiny group who actually do know the truth and are prepared to, you know, on principle, to argue for the right things. The problem is they're backbenchers, and they're usually,
I know,
backbenchers in a small minority of an opposition party, and so they have no power. So, sadly, I spent, you know, a long time thinking about this, a long time researching all over the world, traveling to write my book and kind of analyze the evidence of what goes on all over the world. And no matter what you do, no matter what I say, sadly, no matter what you say, no matter what anyone's done, no matter what Professor Nutt says, nobody's listening. And politicians don't listen to stuff that doesn't get them votes. So for me, I'm really deeply kind of sceptical that we'll see any form of change in any reasonable time frame. More likely, it seems to me, as we head towards a UK prison population of 100,000 over the next year or two, a total UK population of approaching 100,000, including Scotland and Northern Ireland. More realistically, I think we're going to end up going the transatlantic route, which is more and more people in prison, more and more gang culture and gang violence in our major cities, and a doubling or tripling down of all the things we're doing wrong, because we you know, like Americans, British voters are very attracted to the tough on crime message, in inverted commas, even though the tough on crime policies that politicians follow are not tough on crime at all. They're tough on all of us because they make crime worse.
No, you put it great. So you do that. So it's a great way to put it. When I was researching you, Chris, I seen a clip with you with Jeremy Kyle, and obviously it's people like him. And I'm not, listen, I don't know Jeremy Kyle, but it's that kind of straight away, oh, lock them up, and why are they getting this? And blah, blah, blah. And you blew him out of the water, and he couldn't really answer you. But it was these kind of things where people like yourself don't get that platform in the way that, I don't know, somebody like Swella Braverman or something like that would be able to talk, and instead of listening to somebody like yourself who's actually in there and kind of on the ground working with these clients, seeing the trauma. And I try and say as much as I can, I try and push this to the back. Some of the backstories of prisoners and criminals are horrendous, are really horrendous. People don't know, like your Jacob Rees-Mogg's and that. They will never, ever be able to kind of relate to that.
No, because when I went to Pullman, I filmed for a BBC show a few years back, in 2019, and the governor there was an amazing woman, and she was incredibly intuitive about the plight of the young people in her care, as she saw it. Although, as you know, Pullman is, you know, not really a caring institution in principle at all, but that's how she saw it. But she rightly pointed out that some of the young people in Pullman had experienced not one, not two, but maybe five traumatic life events, such as the death of a close family member. Five deaths in unnatural circumstances for one young person under the age of 18. And none of, like, most people just can't remotely imagine what that must be like, what the impact of that must be. And then at the age of 14 and 15, they're then for some usually relatively minor offence, although sometimes violence is involved at court, but they're sent to a prison, you know, with that background. Any civilised society, firstly, taking it as being civilised, would say this young person needs our care and protection. They don't need to be locked up and traumatised even further. And secondly, just set aside all of that stuff, just using your common sense. Your common sense will tell you, if we do lock this person up in this way, what's going to happen is they're going to get more traumatised and they're going to come out and commit more crimes. So, you know, it's just a basic use of common sense.
No, we've had like the Fritzi Hotsman on, who's like, she does the Compassionate Prison Project in America, and she's coming over soon to kind of do another one, and hopefully we'll be able to take part in that. But she points out, she does like a kind of ACEs test, and she points out and allows guys in prison to recognize the trauma. Because what I try and always say is, I think where I was lucky again, Chris, is I was kind of lucky. I'd done a degree kind of law and politics whilst I was in prison, but I was kind of lucky to have that tiny wee bit of awareness that allowed me to see a wee peek behind the veil and go, this is all facade, it's like, it's all fake, it's no real, like, this whole thing is just traumatizing everybody here. And I would say, probably, if you took a 30-year-old, the person that we're talking about that's been reoffending in and out of prison, I would say that nearly, probably high 90% would have PTSD. I would say they would actually have PTSD, and just because of how prison operates. People say prison's a holiday camp or this kind of stuff, and I'm like, oh my God. See, if you, like, it's unbelievable the views people have got on it.
Yeah. People who haven't even been there as a visitor, let alone as an inmate. And so, you know, it's unsurprising. Ignorance will do that to you, you know, and ignorance combined with politicians and newspaper headlines, which are so kind of, you know, the number of times you see the word evil monster and all these things about people, you know, including children, you know, who have got involved in these high profile cases. That sort of language, unsurprisingly, is quite powerful, and it influences the way people think about things, what they don't see and actually don't really care about. I mean, the number of times you say, you talk about Jeremy Carl, but the number of times I've done interviews where I've talked about a sort of a high profile murder case or some other sort of really quite serious criminal case, and I've explained about, you know, the background of trauma or psychosis, mental illness, which often is, you know, underlies a lot of the particularly serious violent crime, and people go, who cares? Why are you so concerned about them? And I'm going, well, the reason I'm concerned that someone has a psychotic mental illness is because that's not their fault, you know. And if you're going to punish someone for the what nature sadly has done to them in terms of their brain, and that's combined with, of course, often traumatic childhoods, if you're going to punish someone for things they haven't controlled and have no control of, where does that end? You know, when do you stop punishing people? You know, and really what that does for me is, in the end, it tells me punishment of itself is a bad idea because it doesn't achieve anything good for our society. And even those who say, well, it's good for the victims because they get closure or they get this and that, but it's not good for the next victim of the next person who loses someone to knife violence or murder, because we've just locked people up at young ages and let them then come out and sadly often go on to commit much more serious crimes. So it's not really good for victims either.
No, I think obviously you need to always take victims into account. And I think victims, 9 times out of 10, of quite rightly so, are going to be very, very kind of raging at the start. They'll have a lot of anger. There'll be a lot of resentment. There'll be so much stuff that plays out at the start of a kind of maybe a crime, a violent crime or whatever. But I think as time goes on, I think it'd be quite controversial, but I think that if, even like what you were talking about burglaries, right? If you sat somebody across a table that seen that person when they weren't under the influence of drugs, when they weren't under the influence of alcohol, and they were able to kind of restoratively kind of see, why is this person doing this? Ask them, because most guys in prison would do it, would actually go, I'll take part in this. But if you were able to ask, why did you burgle my house? And you were like, it was just a chance. It was just it wasn't a personal attack on you. That would give closure. That would give people,
maybe
no closure, but it would.
Sure.
It would get,
I take your point, and yes, it we call that restorative justice, and yes, it does work sometimes, and yes, some victims do want to kind of participate in that process, but many victims don't. And you know, I don't think you can sort of underestimate, you know, that to a victim, in a sense, why someone did it. It matters in some cases, but in most cases, it probably doesn't matter very much. Mm-hmm. You know, they actually genuinely don't care why someone was in the position where they burgled their house. And that's understandable, because that's not a choice that the victim has made to have their house burgled or whatever it may be. But I think the issue is not so much the individual victim, because that's where we often make a mistake, because many politicians in particular say, well, listen to the victims, and they are up there saying we should lock people up for longer, we need heavier sentences. For me, the problem with that approach is that victims understandably have an emotional, subjective, very personal reaction to the crime that's been committed, which by definition rules them out as being appropriate people to decide the punishment or the sentence, because no punishment or no sentence should be decided on the basis of emotion and because of a personal impact on an individual. The whole point of the criminal justice system is that it's about society choosing through its elected politicians what's the best way to deal with crime when it happens, rather than how do we kind of respond to what victims demand or want. I think victims need and demand for police action when they're burgled, you know, someone to actually turn up and someone to listen to them and actually investigate and so on. Mm-hmm. That's very important. And that doesn't happen. And that's often one of the reasons why victims feel let down, particularly about crimes like burglary, which is a crime that people find so difficult to cope with when it happens to them, understandably, is because they don't see anything happening afterwards. So they ring the police and they don't come. And that really is where I think we're breaking down. But there's a disconnect, it seems to me, between the two things. Focusing on supporting victims when they're victims of crime is really, really important. But allowing victims to somehow feed into the sentencing and the justice process, I think that's where we've gone wrong, and we've gone far too far in that direction. We just need to realise that, you know, as a society, we have to accept that victims, like some victims will want the death penalty for whoever's killed their child or their husband. Others will not, because they're Christian and they believe in redemption, and they'll say, actually, so you can't just choose based on which kind of victim you have. You know, one wants the death penalty, one actually doesn't believe in the death penalty, or one wants someone to go away and throw away the key. The other one says, actually, with education and support, I'd be happy if that person came out and lived a law-abiding life. I'd much prefer that, actually, rather than wasting away in prison for 50 years. That's the problem. You're going to get all of those different views of all of those different victims. They shouldn't have any influence at all, because it's society that has to choose. And society, in my view, is making the wrong choices, and often in the name of victims who actually, I've sat down with the family, for example, of a young man who was killed, stabbed to death outside a pub, and I filmed an interview with his family. They were very fierce death penalty advocates, and they said he should have been, knocked away, et cetera, and then he should have been given the death penalty. And then I went through his background of, traumatic child abuse. He'd been 12 when he first arrested. He'd done a year or 18 months in the Young Offenders Institution, already addicted to drugs, psychotic, mental health problems, et cetera. And I said, look, basically their argument was that when he was sent to the Young Offenders Institution for 2 years or 3 years, it wasn't long enough. And my argument was, actually, it was going in there that's probably led to your son being stabbed to death. Because if he hadn't gone in there at the age of 14, and if you'd have diverted him into a therapy and everything else, the chances are your son would still be alive. So actually, when victims are confronted with the reality of what works, they often stand back and say, do you know what? Set aside my emotion. I get that, because I'm bound to feel this way. I can understand, actually, there is an argument for possibly doing things a different way. So that's why we should be very, very cautious about being victim-led, as opposed to receiving information from victims, of course, but ultimately deciding what is going to make sure that we don't have more victims, which is, you can't do anything about the victims of crimes that have already happened, but you can do something to make sure there are fewer victims in the future. And that's really where I think we need to be aiming.
No, I take your point, and I agree with you. I think I've never actually looked at it that way, in the way that you kind of that the victim's obviously going to be coming from. He's going to be shooting from a point of kind of resentment, poisonous kind of venom at the time, and some happens, and quite rightly so. On that, that's a natural kind of reaction. But to draw a legal system on top of that is obviously what we go against. That's the whole point of having a jury system, isn't it? To kind of try and stay away from that. Can I bias? Can I look? No, so I take your point massively on that there, Chris. One of the other things I was going to ask you about was obviously joint enterprise, right? Joint enterprise is something that I'm quite, I know Jan Cunliffe and I know some of the people that, and I totally disagree with that law. I don't know. I think obviously when you're maybe robbing a bank, and if maybe three or four of you are going to rob a bank and there's a kind of criminal plan or it's premeditated, then there is a place for joint enterprise. But I think the way it's getting rolled out in England is atrocious in some cases. I don't know how you feel about that, Chris.
Yeah, I think the problem in England, I can't comment on Scotland, but in England, we only have one form of murder. We don't have like first, second, third degree, etc. So what happens is that the only real way to charge people where there's been a killing and a murder, that, for example, a stabbing in a gang situation or a shooting in a gang situation, the only way to sort of draw the other people who were present and part and parcel of the attack is by charging them all with murder, for which the sentence is automatic life. There's no kind of shades of grey or in between. Of course, the length of time in prison changes, but the sentence is life, regardless of whether you're, you know, the getaway driver that's there and isn't even at the scene of the attack and doesn't even, you know, isn't even present when someone is shot or stabbed, or you're the one actually opening fire with a you know, firearm. It's the same basic crime and the same sentence. I think the answer is actually to move to a situation where you have different degrees, different categorizations and different classes of homicide, which allow for many more variations on the theme. But also, I think, the truth be told, many of those who are caught up in the sort of periphery of these murder cases, in gangland cases, are often very young people, sometimes under 18, who are part and parcel of a gang culture in Glasgow or Manchester or London or wherever. And often, you know, they haven't remotely got the sort of the desire to kill anyone or for anyone to die. It's just that they're kind of there out of a form of loyalty, coercion or whatever. And I think many of those people would be far better to try and divert them away from criminal justice, and certainly locking them up for another 10 or 15 years on a murder charge. It just, once again, set aside the huge waste of money that represents to society, and think of the good you could do with that 40,000-50,000 a year that you're wasting on putting someone in prison. But set all of that aside, and that's a form of insanity that is really difficult to compute. But just again, from that broad overview, what do we want the outcome to be? If we lock up that 16-year-old for 10 years who was, you know, present but didn't do anything, what are they going to do with the rest of their lives? Almost certainly nothing useful. And you know, that's the almost inevitable outcome. Whereas if we once again divert them away from it, try and get them into a secure educational environment, get them away from gang influence, etc., there's a chance that, at least, it may not be guaranteed by any means, but there's a chance that person will be able to live a law-abiding life once they become an adult. At the moment, we're just locking them all up and dragging, it's like a dragnet kind of thing. Anyone who's anywhere near it gets dragged into it, charged with murder, 6, 8, 10 young people in the dock at once in these big murder trials, gang trials. It's all madness. It's complete madness. And you know, even for those often who are the one holding the knife or the gun, they themselves are often not necessarily a fully developed kind of adult with adult kind of understandings and sensibilities. And, you know, many of them are subject to pressures, external and otherwise. So I just think, you know, joint enterprise is a good example of a law that isn't fit for purpose and needs to be looked at. And many, many people are in prison now on the basis of playing almost no role in a crime like murder, which really, if you're going to be convicted of murder, you should at the very least play some very significant active role in causing someone's death. Otherwise, it's not really murder, in my opinion.
No, I think I'm sure Machiavelli is one of the best ways to hurt somebody is give them a sense of injustice. And I think that I've worked with obviously my case, I'm not going to go into my case, that's for a different time, but I worked with like miscarriage of justice victims, and I've worked with like Paddy Hill, and I've seen like loads and loads of guys who were kind of in the miscarriage of justice, and I believe that they're the kind of most the least kind of valued and the sense of kind of injustice that they see, it really takes over their life, like genuinely takes over their life.
in a way that it's very hard to get through to anybody and say, look, you need to accept this, because that word acceptance is a bad word to these people.
Yeah.
So putting people like that are in joint enterprise, guys who you're talking about, a 16-year-old who genuinely was round the corner, didn't know that that stabbing was going to happen. What good is it sending him to prison for 15
well,
years?
They did know that that stabbing was going to happen. I mean, let's get real. Some of them often do. Many of them do. But even if they did know that was going to happen, that doesn't it doesn't make them, in my view, guilty of murder or shouldn't do. And equally importantly, locking them up just because they were on, you know, around the corner knowing that someone was going to stab someone doesn't achieve anything useful. You know, can achieve much more good by not locking them up, even if they did know. You know, and even if they did have some awareness of what was going to happen, because they're not ultimately responsible for it just because they knew and came to a scene of somewhere or nearby the scene of something. In my view, that's just a line too far. And if we're going to call people murderers, let's you know, make sure that that's for doing something that is actively involved and deliberately involved in killing someone, not just being, as you say, on the periphery of something. And even if you've got some knowledge of what's likely to happen, I think we've just gone way too far with this joint enterprise.
No, I think the label thing's a big thing as well, because obviously, like, you're labelled with, like, Peter Tobin's a murderer, Ian Huntley, people like that are, like, murderers, and then you get that label as well, and you're like, that's really no the same thing. Like, it's really very different. And I know victims' families will say it's the same thing, and they're quite rightly so, they can have their opinions. But I think the way you break stuff down, Chris, is amazing. I think the way you logically break stuff down, it's quite hard to argue with in any kind of way. I think that you keep going back to the same thing, which is don't lock people up, and it will kind of stop future victims, which to me is so logical. It's just that there's no really an argument for against it that would suit, I don't think.
Well, you make a good point there, because when I was filming my BBC show, when we were sort of looking at the structure, it's called Crime Are We Tough Enough? And basically, we had me arguing from the point of view that we're doing everything wrong and we should stop locking so many people up and all the points that I've been making today. And we had a discussion with the production team about we needed someone to kind of give the other side of the argument. You know, who's going to argue we're getting it wrong, we need to lock more people up, etc. And we thought logically, well, let's go and find some recently retired, very senior police officers, you know, retired chief constable or that kind of person. Every single one we approached said, well, I agree with Chris. You know, I agree we're getting it all wrong. It's crazy that we, the police, don't, you know, it's not our choice. We're told what the law is. We're told to go and arrest these kids and lock them up. That's, you know, what politicians and, you know, are telling us to do. We have to do it. And we ended up, we did find a solicitor who acted for victims and doing victim compensation, who was willing to come along and argue that, you know, that there should be longer sentences. But it's actually quite hard, to, as I said to you earlier, to find people who work in the system every day in criminal justice, in whatever capacity, to find someone who believes that we've got it right or that we should have more prison and longer sentences is actually very, very difficult, you know, because evidence is evidence. But we just keep circling back, I'm afraid, to the problem of disconnect between what works in reducing crime and supporting both victims and supporting those who have been involved in criminal offences of some kind, and what politicians are prepared to promote at election time and through their policies. And unfortunately, there's just no connection between the, you know, it's rather like, I suppose, you know, we all know that driving at 150 miles an hour is inherently more dangerous than driving at 70 miles an hour on the motorway. But it's almost as if we had a society that even though we all know that, the government says you have to drive 150 miles an hour. And that's the way, you know, you're just doing a thing that everybody who's got any rational analysis of it knows is going to make things more dangerous and worse. But we're doing it anyway because politically it's very popular and sounds attractive. So, you know, the more that you keep doing things that both common sense and, more importantly, evidence say are the wrong things, the worse your outcomes are going to be. And the exponential kind of path that takes you on is towards mass incarceration, which in the United States involves 2.5 million people being in prison at once, which is almost 1 in 100 of the whole US population. You know, and when you just get your head around what that costs, what that does to communities that have lost all of their young people, you know, I've been went to a church in Atlanta where there were hardly any men, It was a black church. There was hardly any men there because nearly all of them were in prison. You know, the only men there were over 60 or over 70. All the young men were locked up. So you have all these mums and wives and children, and they've got no male kind of role model or support in the community because their policy is so insane that you have so many people locked up for so long. Well, the more you keep doing what we're doing, the closer you get to that system. And what we should be doing is applying a hard stop brake and moving directly in the opposite direction. No sign of it, though. That's the problem. You and I can talk about this all day long. You from your incredibly valuable and experienced perspective, and me from my very different but hopefully experienced perspective. We can talk about it all day long, but who the hell is listening that has the power to do anything about it? That's the problem.
I think it's the, when you look at the any system, I've said that, take the top end, for example, and with the top end, Chris, you'll know this yourself, I don't know what it's called in England, but the top end is when you come up to the end of a kind of long sentence and it's the first part of your kind of training for freedom, when you go out for your tour visits and it's like escorted home leaves and stuff. Now, the success rate in there is honestly like, this is me being kind of kind, 1 in 10, right? So see, if you owned a business and you were getting like any kind of success rate, like you were talking about, like an 80% reoffending rate, a 1 in 10 person going through a system and getting to the other side, you would say, this is broke, this is madness, we need to stop this business. But I'm going to ask you this, and this is my view, Chris. Sometimes I look at it and I see the poverty. Poverty is obviously the biggest factor in my kind of view. But I think, see, if we solved crime, just say we solved crime overnight, or we had a magic wand, the amount, I think there's quite a lot of society revolves around crime in the way that we've got police, we've got addiction nurses, we've got prison officers, we've got judges, we've got QKCs, we've got lawyers, we've got like so much invested into this system. Is there a chance that's maybe why we don't try and change the poverty?
Definitely. So very rarely do you know, Turkeys vote for Christmas, and I think the truth is that people like me, on the whole, you know, I frankly would be quite happy to be unemployed, i.e. there to be no need for criminal, you know, defence barristers at all, because we'd solve the problem of crime. You know, I'd be quite happy with that because, you know, I've got other things I can do. You know, I've been involved in other businesses and I do television and all sorts of other stuff. So I'd be quite happy doing something different. But I think most people in most of the jobs that you've just described actually would kind of question, you know, if we did shut down two-thirds of our prison estate, you know, you're right to point out there are many very experienced sort of prison officers, probation officers and others, you know, who would feel, well, what am I going to do now? You know, is there going to be a job for me? And you know, you have to find some way to navigate that economically. You know, there are areas of the country which do depend very heavily on the local large prison. It's a big employer. It purchases an awful lot of stuff from businesses and that kind of thing. And in America, it's a multi-trillion-dollar industry, the prison, sort of industrial prison kind of complex, often run by private companies, making huge profits, often donating to politicians to get politicians to promote longer sentences, and the whole thing goes round and round in circles. I mean, the biggest madness of all is where you have judges in America standing for election whilst they are also being, you know, paid for and supported by the local prison company, you know, how do you get your head around that? And you know, obviously their incentive is to give the longest sentences they can because they're on the payroll. Now, we're not quite at that extreme, but the point you make is a good one, which is there are a lot of vested interests. A lot of people do make their living from the current status quo. And I'm not saying that people cynically want to perpetuate the status quo for that reason. But I think that's one of the reasons why many people, particularly those who are employed in the system, as opposed to me, who's a self-employed person, you know, I can work in other areas. I don't just have to work in criminal work. I can do other kinds of work. So you know, it's different for me. But someone whose whole career is employed within the criminal justice system, really difficult for such a person to say, okay, let's just get rid of my job overnight. You know, and I get that. Mm-hmm. But that requires a big picture kind of plan on the part of government. You know, and it requires investment in communities where perhaps there's been a high level of dependency on jobs in criminal justice and big prisons. You know, you have to do it all as a joined up thing. And ultimately, you know, surely better for society to have fewer cops fewer prison officers and fewer criminal barristers, because that's an indication not of failure, but of success.
No, you're right. And I think if you look at Dostoevsky, he says, like, you should judge a society by looking at its prisons. And I think when you look at prisons and you look at the kind of way that it's, as again, it's a backwards kind of way of teaching somebody how to live, and then you put them, I've actually seen guys being liberated that have been on maybe methadone for 7 years, and they get liberated with, and they don't have a doctor's script, they don't have any money, they don't have anywhere to go, they don't have a house, they don't have, you're saying to them, so you're expecting this guy to go 3 days to see a doctor without any methadone, you're expecting him to live on the streets and kind of no commit any more crimes or get involved in the past people that he kind of maybe went about with, and you're like, how is this even, like, I just it's beyond me, Chris. It's really
You make a really good point about heroin in particular, because heroin, and we all know the problems that the UK and in particular Scotland has had with heroin.
And I think with fentanyl hits, I don't think we're ready for it. I really don't.
No, you're absolutely right. And the truth of it is, I went to Switzerland when I was researching my book, and over there for many years, 20 plus years, they've had heroin-assisted treatment programs where they give heroin away for free, because heroin's actually very cheap to produce. You know, it's just expensive when it's on the black market, and dealers and importers and everyone's, every single stage of the supply chain, there's more and more and more profit, more cutting, more everything else. But pharmaceutical heroin is actually very, very cheap to produce. And in Switzerland, they have a policy where first of all, they've made addiction a disability, which gives you all of the same rights that you have if you have any other form of disability, whereas we've specifically legislated to exclude addiction to alcohol and drugs from our kind of disability rights kind of legislation, which again is a form of craziness when you think about it. But so they firstly, they've given people constitutional rights when they are addicts to whatever they're, it might even be gambling, it doesn't matter, but they are, everybody has a right to treatment if they're an addict in the same way as all disabled people do. But get this, what often happens is they'll go to a heroin assisted treatment program, and I went there and I spoke to the doctors, I was kind of spent some time in these places. They get there, they get a dose of heroin, which is kind of established over a period of time as to what they need as a maintenance dose, and they get it in the morning and they get it in the evening completely free of charge. They get access to doctors, they get access to nurses, and there's even a nurse in the consumption room in case somebody has an overdose, and then they can step in and save their life, which surely should be at the top of the tree when it comes to policy priority. But the point being, once they come in the morning, they then go to work or go to university. What they don't do is go on the streets and find a way to find another 50 or 100 quid for the next, you know, or 20 quid or 10 or whatever it is, for the next load of crap quality street drug that they have no idea what strength it's going to be. So your scenario is a good one. That person's going to end up probably back on the streets on street heroin pretty rapidly. But actually, what they should be is they should be on relatively safe heroin, because most people don't realize that heroin, provided you know the quantity of heroin that's in it and the purity, etc., it's not going to kill you on itself. What's going to kill you is everything that goes with it, the lifestyle, the need for the money, the involvement with drug dealers and gangs, all of that will kill you, but the heroin itself won't. And so if you get away from this idea that the drug is the problem and get and realize that the problem is not the drug but the consequences of drug being prohibited and only supplied by criminal gangs, then you might start getting somewhere. But at the moment, we still have this idea that drugs, in inverted commas, are evil, wrong, etc. Drugs are just chemicals. That's all they are. They can't be evil in and of themselves. It's what we as a society choose to do about them or with them that creates the problem, not the drug itself. You're right. It's absolute insanity that we're not just giving away heroin. Funny enough, that's what we used to do in England before the misuse of drugs laws came in the early 70s, and we only had 1,000 heroin addicts in this country in the late 60s, and they all got their drugs from doctors on prescription, and they knew exactly what they were taking. Most of them still worked or had a sort of ordinary life around their drug dependency. But as soon as the misuse of drugs laws came in, within a decade or so, we had 300,000 people addicted to street heroin. Because of the Misuse of Drugs Act. And you know as well as I do, and probably better, the impact of street heroin, street drugs, including fentanyl, all the other stuff, on society, on certain communities of our society, and all of that is our fault. We did it. We passed that legislation. We double down, triple down, quadruple down on that every year as people getting 20 and 30 year sentences for drug trafficking. We do all of that stuff and we expect somehow, miraculously, it's going to solve our drug problem, even though we created it in the first place. And the only way to stop it is to reverse course and go back to where we were before.
No, it's definitely, I totally agree with you, Chris. And I think when you look at the, when you look at the madness that alcohol isn't classed as a drug, it's beyond me. That I would say that the high kind of, I would say 60-70% at least are in prison through alcohol based crimes, maybe higher. But to have that, to have alcohol, I think if alcohol was brought out today and it was a brand new drug, it would be class A. It would definitely be a class A drug, and there would be a massive. Well, look at Prohibition. You just look at the way Prohibition happened. It created, that was the kind of creating the mafia. We created so much organised crime on the back of Prohibition. Surely that should have been a lesson.
Well, you would have thought so.
You can't.
But I think most people don't realise why we have the Misuse of Drugs Act and why it came in 1971-72. It was because Richard Nixon, who's a very famous American president, corrupt crook who ended up having to resign. But Richard Nixon was campaigning for re-election, and he decided that his big policy was going to be the war on drugs. And he was going to, he because American influence was so wide and he was trying to distract attention from the Vietnam War and everything else, he basically pressurized the entire world into introducing very, very draconian criminal drug laws. And they introduced the American Controlled Drugs Act at the same time. And he made all of the countries of the world, Britain, most of the European countries, sign up to a commitment that they would criminalize heroin and cannabis and all the other stuff, and that they would impose serious criminal penalties. So it's only because of political pressure from one American president standing for re-election, who we all know was a crook at the same time, burgling the Democrats and all the other stuff, we're paying the price for his madness for over 50 years later. And so, you know, in my lifetime, I was born in 1970, that was before the Misuse of Drugs Act. In my lifetime, we've gone from a system, like I said before, where we've got, you know, relatively humane and compassionate and rational approach to heroin addiction, which is to say that it's a medical and psychological or psychiatric condition, to now treating it as part of this whole huge worldwide criminal kind of supply chain, which leads to probably millions of deaths a year when you take account of overdose, when you take account of violence in producer countries, as well as all of the kind of stages of supply along the way. It's costing millions of lives. It's costing trillions of dollars, and it's making our societies more dangerous and worse. So once again, you apply a little bit of common sense to all of that undoubted factual information, and surely it tells you we need to be going towards a Swiss model as far as heroin is concerned, and a more compassionate and rational model for drug supply, not this crazy war on drugs that can't be won and never will be.
No, I agree with you, Chris. I'm going to kind of change the scene a wee bit, just as we're kind of coming up to the last part of the podcast, and talk about international law, how you see international law at the moment. I see quite a lot of stuff going on that I don't agree with, and kind of like Palestine and Ukraine and different things. And obviously people have got different views and they're entitled to it. What's your kind of view? I think there's quite a lot of kind of treaties getting broke. There's a lot of international law getting kind of ignored. I don't know, what's your take on it, Chris?
Well, I think we've got a vacuum of leadership in the most powerful countries. And so obviously the US still remains the most powerful country militarily, economically, in every other way, but we've got a vacuum of leadership in the US in the form of a president who isn't particularly popular. He's over 80 years old, and who's kind of almost a bit lost as to why he's there, and he appears to be there only for one purpose, which is to try to defeat Donald Trump. And when you look at Donald Trump, you have someone who's, you know, a cynical, self-interested, absolutely no sort of moral compass whatsoever. And when the most powerful country on earth succumbs to a vacuum of leadership, and you attach that to the sort of pernicious leadership that we see in Russia at the hands of Putin, the bad people and those who are intent on bad things will fill those vacuums of leadership. There was a time, for example, when the US could have exercised some restraint over what's going on in the Middle East, on one side or both sides. But no one's listening to the US. Israel's not, Palestinians, and Russia, of course, has its own reasons to try to inflame that conflict, to divert attention from Ukraine. So I think all of this, you know, look at the UK. You know, the UK used to be a big part of the EU, used to be a big voice on the international stage. You know, I have American friends, highly educated. I went to spend some time with them last week, and one of them was over here last weekend, and they'd never heard of Rishi Sunak. And so, you know, that we're not making an impact internationally when we're changing prime ministers. Mm-hmm. No one can understand why the prime minister's changed so many times, unless they, you know, well, still, I don't think most British people do, but certainly most Americans and most overseas people just see Britain as this sort of rudderless ship. And so, and we're getting no real leadership from France. We're getting no real leadership from China. Is a malicious actor on the world stage, often, you know, just investing only in its own economic and military interests at the expense of human rights and local freedoms in the countries that it gets involved with. So we just, I'm afraid, have this perfect storm of either sort of a vacancy or a vacuum of leadership, as with most of the sort of Western countries like the US and European countries. And then set against that, we have this sort of, you know, really quite dangerous leadership in Russia and China, the other kind of poles, if you like, of international influence. India sitting sort of somewhere in between, growing influence, but not using its influence really for the good in any significant way, often supporting Russia and using Russia as a source of energy, of cheap energy. So unless we grapple with these, you know, these big issues, for me, I think it all comes down to this. I think in the West in particular, which, you know, we live in genuine democracies. We don't live in fake democracies like Russia, where he can be re-elected, you know, and no one really has a choice. But, it, you know, we do have a choice. We do still vote in Britain and we can make choices. The problem for me is, who is the inspirational leader who has powerful and positive views about how things need to change, both nationally, internally, but also internationally, who can actually command respect, who can command enthusiasm, who, you know, who can win an election with a mandate to go out there and do good things. And we just don't have a leader of any party at the moment. And Keir Starmer, I count amongst them, afraid. You know, I have a lot of respect for him. I'm sure he's a very clever guy and has lots of good intentions. But we don't have a huge uprising of enthusiasm for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party in this country, either north or south. And so until we get someone, you know, I hesitate to say it, someone who can inspire like Tony Blair did all those years ago, you know, I know he made lots of mistakes and did lots of things that people object to, but you can't argue with the fact that he carried people with him and carried people towards, you know, different visions of society. Unless we get someone, I'm not saying a Tony Blair-like figure, but someone who's got that level of public enthusiasm and support, sadly, our political system is going to become more discredited, and we're actually going to see ourselves shrinking even further into the background on the world stage. And unless America can get rid of this kind of strange binary kind of politics where it's all a zero-sum game, America too will fade away in terms of significance, or maybe just fade within its own borders. And you know, world power is going to be left to the Russians and the Chinese and largely to the Indians. And I'm afraid it's not going to be a positive outcome any more than it is for our criminal justice system over here.
No, I agree so much. Some of the debates I've had, like regarding kind of Palestine and regarding things that I say, like people are so, like we say, like the in society are so hard on crime, like get them, like he killed somebody, throw away the key, bring back the death sentence for this person. But just kind of like, just it's as if they don't want to admit what's happening in Palestine. We're killing mass loads of people for, to me, it doesn't seem for kind of any reason. Like Hamas, I understand if that's different, if they're going to fight with Hamas, but that's not what's happening. To me, it's just a kind of genocide, but that's obviously for only my opinion. But I think that what you're saying so right, we had Neil Mackay on no long ago as well, when he was saying he's actually really scared if Trump gets re-elected. He says, I'm actually really scared about what the outcome could be here. He says, I don't know, like, obviously that takes us into another 4 years of Trumpism. And what is that going to be like for the world?
Well, I mean, the best that it could be is that it involves in the US essentially becoming isolationist. That's the best case scenario. But the problem with US isolationism is that because the US has so much of the world's military infrastructure, including all over the world outside, with borders in Europe, through NATO, etc. And the problem is that if the US does become isolationist, it creates just more opportunity for bad actors like Putin to gain further territory through military action and further influence through, you know, the huge number of different ways in which Putin does that, you know, social media, you know, fake accounts and messaging and propaganda and everything else. Likewise, the Chinese, you know, we've seen an awful lot around the Chinese, you know, access to our telecommunications networks and our transport infrastructure and our mobile phones and everything else, and the fact that that data finds its way back to Beijing. So I think the danger of a Trump administration is that effectively it enables those who are intent on damaging and destroying sort of democratic values and freedoms to you know, make things worse in marginal areas of the world. Whether that be Palestine, whether that be, you know, Ukraine, or whether it be anywhere else, you know, Taiwan, all of these places, unfortunately, you know, they are trigger points for potential regional conflicts, which could actually get worse and worse and worse just because America decides through Trump not to be involved or to give explicit support, as Trump has done to Putin in the past. And if that happens, then I think we're in for an extremely rocky 4 or 5 years.
No, I agree. I agree so much. And I think Saudi Arabia coming in is a weird one. I think that them coming on the scene, big player, obviously, they have tons of money. And that, obviously, they're doing these kind of sports things. They're kind of trying to show that they're not the kind of outrageous country that they are with the terrible human rights stuff that goes on there. I think how we can accept Saudi Arabia and allow them just to kind of, and deflect what they're actually doing with their people, human rights. And then, obviously, looking at the way we've come out, the European Union, where do you see that, Chris, in the way that when we write up our Bill of Rights, has the UK wrote their Bill of Rights yet, like their kind of Human Rights Act?
No,
that's not been done yet, has it?
No, at the moment. So we've got a situation where we have the government every 5 minutes saying that we don't agree with what the European Court of Human Rights says about X, Y, and Z. We have them trying to pass legislation that effectively would opt us out of the European Convention of Human Rights in relation to Rwanda. But not actually having the sort of courage, if you like, or possibly the support in Parliament to rip up the European Convention on Human Rights and start again. So we're in a kind of limbo situation where we're still signatories to the European Convention, and we're still in theory bound by it. But we have a government that's saying, well, we can ignore it whenever we want. Now that's a halfway house that I just don't think is sustainable. But you know where it leads us. Frankly, I suspect that the government are going to lose the next election, and therefore this issue to a degree is likely to go away because Labour has no appetite to take us out of the European Convention of Human Rights. And if they come to power with anything like a decent majority, I think that whole issue will possibly disappear off the table. But it will still be a big political football because, you know, it's so easy for the Tories to kind of attack European human rights laws because, you know, it's a bit like attacking criminals in inverted commas or attacking drugs in inverted commas. Attacking Europe has become, you know, a very easy and conventional soundbite for Tories in particular to use. and so, you know, if Labour do win and they win, you know, they will face relentless weekly, monthly attacks from the right-wing loonies who will take over the Tory party. You mentioned Suella Braverman, she'll be no doubt one of them. You know, they will face relentless challenges. You know, what are you doing about Europe? Why aren't you, you know, standing up to them? And, you know, it's an attractive message and the public like it. Hence, they voted in the majority for Brexit.
I know. No, I know. I'm obviously, I would go back to the union. I can't see it. Obviously, I don't think that's even on the table. But I can see that there's a massive gap for, like, one of the things that I think people should know more about is the kind of IPP sentences that I think break quite a lot of human rights laws if you actually look at it. I've got a friend up here. We call it an LRO, a life restriction order, Chris. So I've got a friend that got 2 years, no for killing MD, no for anything. It was a serious assault. Wasn't even attempted murder, it was a serious assault, and he's done 16 years for a two-year sentence. Now, I think when you start looking at that, that's massive. To me, it's human rights breaches, I think, if you look at so much of stuff. But how do we gain that human rights? How do we bring the human rights back to the normal people, to the kind of people society?
You make a good point, you know, because lots of people really have no sympathy for those who are in prison at all, regardless of why they've been in there for so long. IPP sentences, as we call them in England, were of course brought in by Tony Blair's government back in the late 90s, early 2000s, and we still have people in prison from then, you know, who were imprisoned often, not necessarily for a serious assault, as you said, but for fairly low level offending, and they just qualified for an IPP because of the fairly technical way in which the sentence was constructed. So people who were expecting to and realistically should have only spent 2 years or so in prison, as you say, are still in prison after 16, 17 years. And you know, it's an injustice that has to be brought to an end. But one of the problems with imprisoning people for so long when they hadn't committed particularly serious crime in the grand scheme of things is that they have often become entirely institutionalized, and it's even more difficult, therefore, to justify releasing them on parole, because you can't really show a path towards them living a safe kind of normal life where they don't represent any danger to the public, which of course is the test for parole. And so, you know, what we've done in effect is put them in prison when it should have been, if at all, for a short period of time. And then over a long period of time, you've taken it to a situation where it's very, very difficult for many of them to qualify for parole. And that, you know, to me is yet another form of utter insanity and totally counterproductive. What we should do, in effect, is have a presumption that anyone who got a sentence and has served, for example, more than double their tariff on an IPP or an LRO, the presumption should be they should be released unless it can be established clearly that they remain a danger to the public, rather than the other way around. And of course, the other way around makes it very, very difficult for people to achieve parole. And hence, no doubt, your friend and others, and any others, in fact, are still in prison when they really don't belong there at all.
No, again, you break it down just so logically, Chris. I was actually going to take you to your kind of social media where I kind of seen you and your presence on social media. I think you've got such a great outlook on so many stuff. I would have you up here as a Lord Advocate if I could, but. It's one of the ones where your presence. How do you see social media's role, Chris, and maybe even kind of the stuff that we're talking about in society, the believing in the hard crime, the kind of hard punishment? Well, how do you see social media's role?
I'm in two minds about it. I mean, I'm you know, fairly active, as you say, particularly on X or Twitter as it used to be, and also sort of through my YouTube channel. But I actually think we live in a time where I think most people only listen to that with which they agree, and anything they hear that they disagree with on social media, they're prepared to just argue the opposite, usually without any sort of analysis or thought, because social media, of course, lends itself to very simplistic kind of points being made if you've only got a certain amount of space to make your point. And also traction, in other words, you know, likes, etc. on social media tend to kind of overwhelmingly be reserved for extreme simplistic positions on one side or the other. And, you know, often some people accuse me of that. But I think it's a blessing and a curse. I mean, it's a blessing in the sense that everyone can have a voice. And everyone has the opportunity to be heard on their, give their opinion in a way that wasn't the case when I was a child. And, you know, you were relied on the news to hear voices and opinions, or, you know, on mainstream broadcast channels. Nowadays, anyone can say anything anytime. And, you know, some people get very large audiences for saying things which are complete nonsense, conspiracy theories and who knows what else, you know. And so I think it's a blessing and a curse. I think on balance, I mean, people say to me, why do you do it? Because, you know, it's a bit of a sort of madhouse and there's no kind of sensible, rational debate. And my answer is, well, it's just the vain hope that by being part of a kind of conversation, you're better off than not being part of it at all. and allowing the loonies to completely take over the whole landscape, you know, which we have to accept is a landscape in the form of, you know, social media comment, which is very, very powerful and affects a lot of people's opinions. And I think if those of us who have what might be called more, I don't know, constructive, pragmatic, some would say liberal, but I mean, I don't really see it that way. I'm more about evidence. It doesn't, where it sits on the political spectrum is not really relevant to me. It's what works that matters. So some things economically, for example, might be considered right wing. Well, if they work, let's do them. And likewise, other things around social policy and criminal justice might be seen as liberal or left wing. It doesn't really matter what the label is. Just do the thing that works. You know, whether social media in the end is a force for good, overall, if we could go back in time and it never happened, I'd probably say would be better off without it. But we are where we are. So you kind of have to make a choice as to whether you engage with it. And for the time being, at least, I'm giving it a go.
No, I think, you know, I wouldn't stop. And I would say to anybody to give you a follow on Twitter, especially. I think your stuff's great. But what I was going to say, see that environment like that, it can turn toxic, and you can see quite quickly people will say things that maybe they wouldn't say to your face. There's that kind of hidden, you're able to hide behind an account. And I think I was kind of trying to say, and obviously I think it was to my partner, I was kind of saying, do you know what, it's similar in prison, by the way. Prison is that is a facade where you need to put a face on and you need to act a certain way. And Twitter and stuff, you see the toxic way in that people will just back each other up, as you say, without any evidence base. They'll just go, that's my view and I'll back that person. And very quickly you can see that kind of herd mentality where people just go along with what somebody's saying, especially the people that you're talking about with the millions of followers that maybe like your Andrew Tate's of the world and stuff. These people have got massive influence, very articulate, but the people that's backing them and the people that kind of don't really go with any evidence-based stuff. Do you know what I mean? There's no really. Whereas when you put out something that's very well constructed, it's something that you've looked into, you've done your homework, a lot of people are just firing stuff out there that really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, isn't that what's happening largely with the media too? I mean, it's just, if you think about, particularly in the US, so in the US, people, I mean, there's been some research on this recently, but people essentially choose to follow or watch whatever television news network suits their own very strong views about things. So they're just looking for a sort of an echo chamber for their own opinions. And so in the States, you have Fox News on the one hand, this sort of extreme right-wing Republican pro-Trump kind of news network. Overwhelmingly, the audience are right-wing Republican pro-Trump kind of viewers. And then you have CNN and then MSNBC on the other side, which are kind of considered largely Democratic, anti-Trump, etc. But people, rather like with social media, people just tend to follow, watch, and engage with that which they agree with. Mm-hmm. So we've gone away from sort of any kind of idea of balance and where you know, and I, you know, I'm not saying you should enforce balance. I mean, we try to in this country through our broadcasting laws to suggest that the BBC is supposed to be balanced and news channels are supposed to be balanced. But ultimately, what's the point of that in some senses if the battle's lost? And on social media, you know, there's no obligation to be balanced. Anybody can say whatever they like. You can have whole networks of social media which are only focused on, you know, certain political perspectives, you know, who believe and agree with conspiracy theories and everything else. So I just, again, it's all part, I'm afraid, of a drift in society away from the rational, away from the sort of pragmatic, and away from, you know, I guess just basic concepts of fairness and equality and things which somehow, even saying fairness and equality now, you can be accused of being woke and you can be accused of, you know, stuff like that. Even though surely fairness and equality, when you kind of strip away everything else, what was the Second World War about if it wasn't a battle against inequality and unfairness in Nazi Germany? You know, that's what the Second World War and almost every war of kind of that's been fought for good reason is about, fairness and equality. But you can't even say those two words now without them being, you know, without you being kind of shouted down as being woke and et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, ultimately, I end up with a fairly cynical view, which is I just think our direction of travel in terms of social media and our mainstream or broadcast media or any other form of media, the direction of travel is negative. The direction of travel is towards binary positions where I can either, you know, Palestine and Israel is a good example. You know, many, many people have an entirely binary view. You're either utterly pro-Israel or you're utterly pro-Palestine. Actually, most significant and complex international issues like that are somewhere in between, somewhere on the spectrum, mm-hmm. as between one position and another. We've just lost the ability to be nuanced and to see balance and to see perspective. And until we get that back, if we ever do, we're going to drift ever and ever towards, I think, a more negative and dystopian future.
No, I agree again, Chris. I agree with you. It's definitely a great point. So see, the kind of last thing I'm just going to bring it to is something that's kind of close to me, is miscarriage of justices, Chris. I don't know how you feel about these, and if you believe like they're still kind of going on. And because what I've found over the last maybe 10 years is that the miscarriage of justice rate's really dropped, in the way that there's no the same amount of people getting out. The stats of kind of the Criminal Case Reviews Commission have kind of been maybe kind of hardened up and maybe tightened up, and it's very hard to get appeals and stuff. I don't know if you know the Luke Mitchell case and stuff up here, where there was evidence destroyed and stuff like that. There's just stuff that's going on. I don't know how you feel about like the miscarriage of justices, and if you think they're still going on.
Yeah, Chris. I mean, I'm sure they do. I mean, if we break it down again without trying to strip away the kind of the emotion of it and just look at logic and reason here, you know, we have a human system called the criminal justice system. We have human systems in the form of courts with lawyers, judges, and juries. And those human systems are by definition imperfect. So what we do is we seek to, at least in England, again, I can't comment on Scotland, but in England, we seek to have, and I'm sure it's the same in Scotland, a very high bar before someone should be convicted, which is beyond reasonable doubt, or so that you're sure. So you know, we stack the system, as it were, in one sense at the beginning in favour of the defendant. But the problem is that only works if the defence is fully and adequately resourced to defend the case. If not, as is the case in England, certainly, with huge legal aid cuts over the last 20 years or so, or even longer, certainly the last 20 years, and even more so the last 11 or 12. But when you actually remove the sort of basic planks of criminal defence, which is, you know, having a lawyer who's got enough experience to deal with you at the police station, having a lawyer who's got enough experience in the first appearance at court, and crucially, of course, having lawyers who have all of the resources they need to defend a child at trial. Mm-hmm. When you remove all of that, and also when you remove resource from the prosecution side to have the skill set, the training levels, the ability to kind of operate a disclosure regime that's fair to the defence and, you know, kind of operates effectively. Mm-hmm. When all of that is kind of taken away, the level of imperfection in the system will rise and you will have more miscarriages of justice. You'll have them in both directions, by the way. You will have more miscarriages of justice in the form of cases which can't be prosecuted, or where the prosecution fails, where the person is guilty because the police are under-resourced, the prosecution don't have enough resource. But equally, and probably more rarely, you will have an increasing number of cases where people are wrongly convicted. But when you link that in to an underfunding of appeal work, whereby lawyers are not really paid to do appeals these days, where the Criminal Cases Review Commission, as you say, is less effective and less resourced, it's just a matter of, it doesn't matter what your views about crime and punishment are, it's a matter of common sense that what will happen is the system will become less effective at identifying the guilty and acquitting the innocent, and that will mean that you will have more and more injustices one way or the other, and equally, as you say, fewer of those injustices, when they happen, will actually be recognized and resolved by a successful appeal. So you're going to have more and more innocent people in prison for longer and longer, and more guilty people, particularly for murders and other serious crimes, who will just never be identified or won't be successfully prosecuted. And that means that it's showing that you've got a system in incomplete dysfunction and disarray. And how do you solve all of that? Well, first of all, you did some of the things I've suggested. For example, decriminalizing, or rather legalizing and licensing drug supply, halving the prison population, and stop locking up children in prisons or calling them criminals. So if you did those three things alone, the amount of money you would save and you could use for other things to try to make communities afflicted by drugs and crime better and safer places, to try to get children victims of trauma, you know, through into adult life and into a law-abiding adult life, and all of the other things, and to stop the revolving door of and vast cost of unnecessary prison sentences. Do all of those things and you start getting someone, you might see some positive change. But sadly, miscarriages of justice are yet another example of a dysfunctional and failed system. And certainly, you know, from my point of view, you know, back in my early days in practice in the early 90s, the number of truly innocent, in inverted commas, people in prison was, you know, percentage-wise, was probably relatively small. There were still some, of course. But now I think the percentage is probably higher and the overall population of prisoners is much higher. So overall, that means there are a lot more innocent people in prison than there used to be. And that surely is not something that any decent person who believes in those basic values of fairness and equality and freedom. You know, freedom isn't something to be sort of taken for granted or taken lightly. Anyone who believes in those things should be saying to themselves, why are we in a situation where we have more and more innocent people in our prisons? And surely we need to be doing something at the very least about that. Because whatever your view about crime, etc., putting innocent people short in prison can't be something that anybody wants. So surely we must look at how we can avoid that happening as much as it does.
No, definitely. I think, with Tony Blair, I think it was Tony Blair that once said they would rather have 10 innocent people in jail than one guilty person outside. But what I would say
Blair, but you're right. I think it was Abraham Lincoln or someone of that kind. But you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, Tony Blair, the only reason I pick you up, because Tony Blair, unfortunately, was responsible for policies which led to big increases in the prison population. And brought in laws which allowed hearsay to be used and other forms of evidence that had previously been inadmissible. So he wasn't a great friend, I'm afraid, of the criminal justice system, even though he was.
No. I was meaning he said they would rather have 10 innocent people inside. I maybe said it the wrong way. Yeah. 10 innocent people inside than one guilty person out. But what I was kind of going to say to that, Chris, is my whole kind of journey through the criminal justice system has seen that most good criminals are outside. This is the thing that people don't understand. Most good criminals are very well equipped to deal with the system. They're very well equipped to deal with, and that's not to say, I've met loads of good guys who are in organised crime and stuff, and it is what it is. There's reasons for them. I don't agree with it. It's not something that I agree with. There's reasons for it. But what you see is these guys are very well equipped to deal with a system that's, and I think, as you say, most of the people that we're getting are maybe guys that are traumatized, addicted to drugs, and very unequipped to deal with a system that's really tough and very, very kind of, you need to have a basic knowledge of how the system works to be able to kind of play with it, if that makes sense to you, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. You know, I've had many clients who are sort of high-level organised criminals, some who were acquitted and kind of walked away from the case with my kind of representation, others who did one length of sentence or another, or who spent some time on remand and then were acquitted, you know, and walked at that stage. And I'd say what many of them have in common at the highest levels, and also I've had many clients who never went near a prison, you know, despite coming on the radar of the authorities. And I think what many of them have in common, actually, is that they're just extremely able people when it comes to running organizations. They have all of the skills you need. You know, they have all of the same skills that you need to run any sort of business. You know, they're good at recruitment. They're good at maintaining supply chains and relationships with suppliers or with distributors. And they give good customer service and all the other, so even people, you know, who are involved in the drug trade at a very high level are often the sorts of people who in another parallel universe would be running, you know, an oil company or a supermarket chain or something like that, because they have all of the same skill sets. The difference is often that they were picked up as a teenager and never really went through education, and so they kind of ended up working their way up the hierarchy of drug distribution in particular, because they can, because they are bright, intelligent, articulate, confident, often, you know, quite, you know, capable of aggression when needed, but actually realize that often that's not the best way to get what you want. And so all of those kind of very nuanced skill sets, you know, they're valuable in the drug business, they're valuable in organized crime of any kind, and they're also valuable in fraud, because I think what many people, when they think about organized crime, They all automatically default to drugs, drug games, drug violence. Mm-hmm. Most, by value, by far the largest group of criminals are fraudsters, and 90% mm-hmm. or even higher of them never ever go anywhere near the criminal justice system at all. And yet, I know. Because they live in nice houses and their kids go to private schools and they don't, find themselves being arrested, there's not great uproar. Even though many of our citizens are defrauded daily by organized crime groups who are involved in, identity theft and all of the other stuff that mm-hmm. organized crime does in those areas. And it's interesting and ironic in a way, isn't it? That we're much more concerned about that relatively small group of very violent drug gangs than the much, much bigger group of largely non-violent fraud crimes and fraud gangs, which mm. have a devastating economic impact on society and many people. And yet all the money gets thrown into drugs and drug enforcement, and very little of it gets thrown into investigating and trying to stop the kind of systemic fraud that we have in so many areas of our life. So the whole thing's fucked up.
Aye. No, I agree, and I couldn't put it any better again as well, Chris. But so honestly, it's absolutely amazing having you on here. But I'm going to just give you the last wee message. I always kind of give the last wee message to the guests, just anything that I've kind of missed out or anything you kind of want to promote, anything like that, Chris. So you can take it away, a wee message just at the end.
Well, a couple of messages. Firstly, as you say, I hope anyone who's slightly interested in what I have to say will follow me on Twitter. It's at CrimLawUK or my YouTube channel, ChrisLawKC, or on LinkedIn for some more business and sort of management type stuff. By all means, follow me on those three. But I think you've covered all of the topics really well. But all I would say, I suppose the guiding principle that I live by when it comes to giving opinions about criminal justice or politics or anything else is be prepared to change your mind. Be prepared to be influenced by evidence of someone else's opinion being right. Because for me, I think the biggest problem we have in our criminal justice system and in our politics, not just in the UK, but everywhere else, as we've discussed, is that everybody's taking extreme sides on everything. And everything's become a zero-sum game. You're either 100% right or you're 100% wrong. And my kind of view is, and my experience over many, many years, is that most things, particularly most important things, are somewhere in the middle of the two extremes. And actually, over a long period of time, we had this broad consensus in the UK, the US, and elsewhere that we would kind of pursue a middle ground, slightly to the right of central, slightly to the left, but there'd be elements of both ways of thinking. In our day-to-day lives, in the way that we think about things and vote, I just think and express ourselves on social media, that is, be prepared to say that someone's got some good ideas, even if we disagree with much of what they say. And if we ran mm-hmm. the world that way, in a more constructive and productive way, I think we would find ourselves in a much better state than we are. We'd have many fewer conflicts, we'd have many fewer economic deprivations, and many fewer very severe adverse outcomes from criminal justice as we have now. So that's, whether people can say, oh, well, nonsense, that's fair enough, but at least give it some thought. And before you decide something's mm-hmm. nonsense, is my view of the best way of conducting ourselves, even though I think most of us, including myself, often are not very good at living by that.
No, I agree. I can do it as well, Chris. So I think it's a great message to end the kind of show. But listen, I can't thank you enough for coming on. It's been absolutely brilliant. I think your outlook, and I think you should just keep shining, keep fighting away, and keep fighting a good fight, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.